93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93X FM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. The most popular new show of early 2016 is Billions, a gripping, soapy new drama set in the world of high-stakes venture capitalism, starring Paul Giamatti and Damian Lewis. The co-creator and executive producer of Billions is Brian Koppelman. Now, even if you don't know that name, you likely know the films that he's made. He's the co-writer of one of the greatest movies about gambling ever made, Rounders. That's the one where Matt Damon tries to save Edward Norton from his self-destructive wagering. As well as other films like Knockaround Guys, Ocean's 13, and The Girlfriend Experience. You may also know Brian from his popular podcast, The Moment, which I suggest checking out. Of course, check it out after you listen to this podcast. But beyond his distinguished professional resume, Brian is at heart a hardcore music nerd, which made him a natural to appear on this podcast. He even worked in the music industry for many years in the 80s and 90s before he started his film and TV career, shepherding the careers of acts ranging from Tracy Chapman to D'Angelo. He also worked briefly as the A&R guy for Metallica, a connection that paid off when the band made a recent cameo in an episode of Billions. As you'll hear in our conversation, Brian has passionate opinions about everything from the Tigers of Pantang to REM to Bruce Springsteen. He even takes me, your humble host, to task for my opinions about Pearl Jam. Though I think you'll find when you listen that I'm right and he's wrong. Anyway, Brian is a great guy and we had a really fun conversation. Here it is. So Brian, you know, this is a music podcast, obviously, but I wanted to begin by talking to you a little bit about your new show, Billions.
Sure.
Because I've been watching it and I'm a big fan, and it's, you know, it's been a great hit. You're already renewed for the second season. Now, I mean, you made your name working in film. I mean, is this your first big television show? Am I wrong on that? Or have you worked in TV before this?
We have worked in TV before. When I say we, I'm talking about David Levine, who's my show running, producing, writing partner. And he and I had a show a few years ago on ESPN called Tilt,
right,
that ran for a season. But this is entirely different, and we're really running, you know, we're the showrunners on this and co-creators. And it's at an entirely different scale, and the kind of audience is different, and the whole thing is really like working in the major leagues. But, dude, I just want to say before we start, you know, I'm so glad you're doing this podcast, because I am a music geek, and I've read you and I've argued on Twitter a lot about music. I think the Counting Crows might be a sore point between us.
That's a point of agreement.
All right, well, good, a point of agreement. I think we might have disagreed on their last record. But
no, because I'm a big Counting Crows defender. I feel like in the critical community, I am an outlier in that regard. I have taken some heat for that, but I will defend the Adam Duritt songbook to the end.
Me too. So actually, it turns out we see that one the same. Though I seem to remember going back and forth a little bit on a fine point on a song on the last album. But the point is, I'm so happy that you have like a real music geek podcast going that you know, it gets into sort of the nooks and crannies of stuff that not that many people care about, but the people who care so fucking much that I think it'll bring in a whole bunch of other people to start caring. So I'm thrilled that you're doing it.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and that's a good segue for me to ask you a music geek question related to Billions, because you know, I really enjoyed the Metallica episode, which was, you know, we're taping this. The sixth episode just aired. I believe that was the Metallica episode. Was that the fourth episode?
Exactly.
And for those who haven't seen the show, you know, it's about, you know, there's this character played by Damian Lewis. His name is Bobby Axelrod. He's this sort of high-powered venture capitalist, and he's squaring off against Paul Giamatti, who plays this attorney for the U.S. Attorney's Office, who's investigating him for various shady business dealings that Axelrod is involved in. In the fourth episode, Axelrod and his buddies, they fly out, I think, to Montreal to go see a Metallica concert.
And Quebec City.
And this is my music geek question. When, you know, I expected the members of Metallica to have some dialogue in that episode, but I assumed that it was going to be Lars Ulrich. He seems to me to be the actor in Metallica, but you threw a curveball and had James Hetfield acting in the episode. Was that like a struggle to decide? Like, did the members of Metallica like argue about who was going to be able to have the acting role in that show?
That was scripted, you know? And look, the idea to us was that if you can get James to talk, right? if you think about words per minute that those guys have fired off in their lifetime. You know, Lars, who I'm a huge Metallica fan. I have been for a very, very, very long time. I got to work with them briefly, and when Dave and I figured out that they'd be Bobby Axelrod's favorite band, and the idea came to have them show up, what we really thought would be great is that for so many people, James is a shamanic figure. You know, especially after Some Kind of Monster, I think it's clear that James is a guy who has been chasing the answers and seems to have found some for himself. And so the notion that James is someone to whom Bobby could speak and relate, right? Because he's a lead singer, he's got all the pressure, he manages this whole thing. The thing doesn't go without James. Like, Lars in the early days famously was a manager and pushed him forward. But the truth is that James Hetfield is the difference maker, the thing that makes Metallica not, look, Lars would have been successful in anything if Lars Ulrich at 14 decided that what he wanted to do was own a company that made rivets. That would have been the biggest rivet company in the world.
Right.
But he stumbled upon James Hetfield and a love of a certain kind of heavy metal, and that enabled him to have the biggest heavy metal band of all time. So for us, look, we shot Lars talking too. Everybody talked a little bit, but the meat of that scene was always going to be looking at James. When James said he'd do it, we had to send the pages over. And until we got there, and until we were standing in the rehearsal room at the arena, and James was smiling at us and saying he'd do it, I honestly didn't know if it would fucking happen, you know? And then for it to come off the way that it did, and for people to dig it the way that they did, everyone seemed to really get what we were doing, and I was so pleased to see that, you know? And for me, it was an all-time great day of being a writer, artist, showbiz, whatever you want to talk about it too. Fly up to Quebec City, the first night this arena opens, to be there with the band, to be in their private rehearsal space, the Inner Sanctum, where no one gets to go, to have those guys saying words that Dave and I wrote, and to be a witness to Damian Lewis getting to play that scene with James Hetfield. I mean, it was, you know, man, that's a top 10 sort of professional day you could ever have.
You mentioned this in passing, that you worked with Metallica briefly in the late 80s. And for people who don't know, I mean, you've established a really successful career in film and television in the last 20 years. But before that, you were in the music business, and you were working for A&R for Elektra in the late 80s. And I think you were their A&R guy for like a year or so, was it?
It was one of these great flukes. So when I was a kid, I was a heavy metal fanatic. It was hard to be, like, to be a real obsessive fan of a particular kind of music, especially non-mainstream music, which metal was, in the early 80s, right? I was in ninth grade in 80. So what I had to do in 79, 80, 81 is, like, read British heavy metal magazines, you know? I'd have to read Kerrang. And then I would look at Kerrang and learn about the new wave of British heavy metal, and then have to find record shops all around the country that would advertise sometimes like in the back, or some artist would be interviewed and like he would mention having gone to a record store, and I would have to write to those record stores and call them and then get them to send me records. And part of that, in doing all of that, being obsessive, you know, I could tell you the B-side of the secret 10-inch on the Tigers of Pantang album. The B-side was Do It Good, which was like their best track, and it made no sense. That wasn't on the album. Like, I knew all that shit and was crazy about it. You know, I'm somebody who had the original Leather Records version of the first Crew album. Through that, I met some managers and stuff. I would call or I would write to a manager of a band, like, hey, are they coming? And because it was still small, and I met the guys who managed Metallica through that process when I was like 16 or 17. And then I went off to college, and as you know, I worked with Tracy Chapman and got her first record deal and did all this stuff. And that happened to be at Elektra Records. They hired me to do A&R. And the guy who, an amazing guy named Michael Alago, really signed Metallica to their first major record deal, Alago also signed like Nina Simone. He was just an amazing New York character, really incredible. But he had left Elektra for another gig. And the Metallica managers remembered me. And even though I was now known for like folk music and my musical taste had completely changed in college, they were like, we think you'll understand our band. Will you be Metallica's A&R guy? And this was right as Injustice for All was coming out. So I didn't have any responsibility creatively in terms of helping them make records, but I was their creative liaison to the record company. And Lars Ulrich called from Germany the first day, like basically my first day working, and said he wanted an edit on the track One, which was the single from that album. You remember that was the one with the Johnny's Got a Gun video. And,
of course.
Lars had the specific edit, which was, you know, when the guitar solo is going, it kind of fades out. And because the track on the album is much longer, and he's like, I don't want some stupid A&R veteran to do some fucked up edits. I want some kid who knows my... So he sends me in. I've never done an edit. I've never been in a mastering lab. I go in. I follow his instructions exactly. I do just the edit he wants. It was nothing creative. It was literally just telling the professionals, don't do what you would normally do. Do what the artist wants. And I sat there and made sure they did, sent it off to Lars, and then he said, you did it right. Our U.S. tour starts in Columbus, Ohio. Be there opening night if you want to hang out. And so for me, this was just incredible. You know, I went to Columbus. I had never had Jägermeister in my life. I wasn't a big drinker. And they looked at me, and James was the most intimidating man in the world. I mean, I was 21, you're maybe 22. I couldn't even look at the guy. He was so scary, he meant so much to me, and he was just so incredibly intense and powerful. And I just remember James holding out a bottle of Jaeger and Lars saying, you can hang out as long as you're drinking that. And if you finish it, you're one of us. And so I basically had gone through college without succumbing to hazing, but nobody can not succumb to the hazing of James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich.
Oh, yeah, and that was, you know, in their, you know, the full bloom of their Alcoholica period.
Oh, that was Alcoholica Metallica, no question about it. And Newstead would take mercy on me, and I think about halfway through the bottle, Newstead took it behind his back and dumped it and gave it back to me and protected me. But it was a great time to be able to go back and forth on the road with them. You know, to those guys, I was just another record company hack who just didn't happen to fuck something up. But to me, it was kind of a formative young man's experience.
I imagine. So you know, you obviously, you know, you have this connection to Metallica that goes back decades, and that pays off in a way when you're doing this show and you want to have them on. But I know, I mean, just knowing you and knowing how big of a music fan you are, I know that there is also, I'm sure, a lot of consideration for the characters on the show and what they're going to like. Like, I always think of, I think Martin Scorsese talked about once how in his movies when he's, you know, because he's probably the best in cinema history as far as using rock music in films, that he always wants to think of what the characters would be listening to and use that in his films.
100%.
And like for you, it seems like that was a very conscious creative choice to make Bobby Axelrod a Metallica fan versus like a U2 fan or whatever.
It was a really conscious choice,
like,
absolutely.
Like how much thought goes into something like that, that maybe a lot of people wouldn't even think about being a big deal, but I imagine is to you.
Oh man, a ton of, I mean, you're like when you're thinking about who these people are, these characters, you want to make them really live and breathe to you as the creator and as the person or the people writing them so that they seem real to the people watching. And so in all of our movies or films, we could probably have told you in some way at the time what the characters listened to and why and what they were into. And yeah, we thought about it. We talked about it. Is Bobby Axelrod a Pearl Jam fan? Because he could have been. He probably likes Pearl Jam fine. But we thought about who he was in high school and how he carried himself and what his attitude was. And then also, when we realized we could use Master of Puppets in the way that we did, it all just made sense to us to make this a real thing. You know, the idea of him walking around in the second, you know, obviously we've seeded this stuff, right? So in the second episode, he's, and spoilers, if people haven't watched the show, please stop. Watch the 6 or 7 episodes that are up before this podcast went up, and then catch back up with the conversation. But in episode 2, he's wearing a Metallica Master Puppets t-shirt at a pretty crucial moment. Then episode 4, you know, they go and see Metallica, and we hear that song. And then at the end of episode 6, after he does a certain thing, that song's playing loudly as he's driving away, and clearly with a huge reason. And so it all just made sense to us that this would represent part of who he is.
I mean, has that always been, you know, something that's worked in your brain? I mean, I know for me, like, I'm obsessed with how songs are used in films. Like, that's something that is always, like, if I watch a movie and they use a song really well, either because it works great with the images or because the song somehow is commenting on the scene in a really clever way, that's something I always gravitate to. And I always hear songs and I'm like, oh, if I were a filmmaker, I would use this song in this kind of scene. I mean,
The song that ends, I won't tell you what it is, but the song that ends the season. Well, first of all, I can say in the first episode of Billions, the song that ends that is an LP track. And there's a Despot track at the beginning of the episode, House of Bricks. And I had those two songs for months and months and months before we shot. I was like, you know what? I have a feeling that that stuff's going to work in the show. I don't know where or why. I knew House of Bricks was going to work. Like, I carried that around. I sent it to Dave, and I was like, dude, just remember this track, and if I forget, remind me of it. We're going to use it. I know in the pilot. Like, nothing was even finished being written, and certainly we weren't shooting. And the last song of the season on Billions, again, I won't say what it is now, but it was a track that it was like, oh, I know how to, we have to deploy this a certain way. I mean, that happens throughout. There's a film that we made that's actually like our best reviewed film. It's called Solitary Man, starring Michael Douglas. And Johnny Cash's version of Solitary Man was in that thing from the moment that the idea for that movie surfaced, you know? And the very first 10 pages ever written for that movie, it was like, Johnny Cash singing Neil Diamond's Solitary Man plays as this, you know, Ben Kalman, the character, walks in a certain place. Lord, I'm Discouraged by the Hold Steady has a huge moment in that film. And again, that was like, oh, that guitar solo can play in this way over this thing because Tad Kubler kills it in that guitar solo. So, yes, I'm constantly making lists of this stuff and keeping it and figuring out how and where to deploy it.
Like, do you have a list of, like, favorite, like, moments that you've seen in other films that you felt like, oh man, they used that song so well in that scene?
I catalog those kind of movie moments in a way because they, I mean, obviously Sunshine of Your Love and everything in Goodfellas, but you don't want to, I don't want to, like, sort of look to those moments as these intimidating, impossible things. So I memorize movie dialogue, and I'll go back and look at the way, you know, I love the Sinatra song at the opening of Wall Street. There are tons of them, but they're not, we're trying to do our own thing in that regard.
Right, right. You know, you mentioned Master of Puppets, you know, recurring in a couple different episodes so far, and that song, not only does it work for the character because he likes the song, but it also comments on the theme of your show in a way which is talking about power and the different ways that people exert power over each other and the psychological reasons behind that. When you're pairing music with something like that thematically, do you start with a song in a way, or do you have like that kind of like, I want to do a show about this, and then the kind of music comes after that?
You know, you feather it all in various different, the creative process. I mean, you know, when you're writing a piece, you know how sometimes you'll come up with a thing in the fourth graph and you'll go, oh, you know what, I can throw that in. If I throw this into the lead, then suddenly it'll make this much better in the fourth graph. I mean, that's kind of what you're doing. You're, you know, these ideas surface and you try to kind of catch them, and then you figure out, well, how can I use this, or is this the best way to use it? And so you go back and forth, right? I don't know if, and a lot of this work happens in the subconscious, so that you're listening to stuff, right? One of the things is I have this incredible amount of curiosity and passion for all different kinds of art. And one of the great things about the job that I have is that it's all applicable. So if I wake up on a Saturday and I want to go see a folk concert, or I want to go listen to on Sirius XM, The Highway, for an afternoon, or if I want to go to see a Matisse exhibit, like, it all, I don't know how I'm going to use those things or why I'm going to use those things, right? But by trying to fill my brain, then my subconscious is going to do the work later and filter out the right stuff when I need it. That's right. What I always think.
Right. I was talking earlier about how earlier in your career you were involved in the music business, and eventually you made this transition into working in film and now television. Was there, and again, your podcast is called The Moment, so I guess I'll turn that question around on you. Like, was there a crucial moment for you for making that transition?
Sure. Excellent. Sure. I mean, a bunch of things started happening, right, that led to this moment that I had. And, I mean, the biggest thing was that my first child was born, and I looked at him, and I realized I wanted to be the kind of father who would come home and say, you can be anything. And that if I was not chasing my dreams, then I wouldn't be telling him and then later my daughter the truth, and I want to tell the truth. So that was like sort of a huge thing that made me decide to make this seismic shift somehow. But like, I had started to become depressed about the gig. A&R is incredible. If you're a music fanatic, it's the best job in the world in many ways. But you're really not allied with the artist. And if what you care about is the artists, then you're put in a position where you're forced to lie and dissemble. And to somebody, your artist calls you from Kansas City and the records aren't in the store, the CDs aren't in the store, and the promotion guy has told you that the radio station's expecting them, except now that they know that there are no records in the store, the sales guy's screwed. And you're just constantly trying to cover people's asses. Plus, you believe so much in these artists, and you go to the ends of the earth for them. And then I would have trouble sometimes getting people to see the vision within the company, or because they were thinking about their jobs, right? And it's always easy for people in positions of authority to say no or to throw money at the thing that's already selling. Like, I signed David Gray and made his first U.S. album. And I think it sold 2,000 copies. The next one sold 3 million. And I would go see David Gray and I'd be like, are you not seeing this guy? Does anyone else sing like that? Does anyone else write melodies like that? Like, that guy's going to be a big star. And over that would happen. I signed Five for Fighting, and I'm sure you don't like their music, but that guy is a songwriter who sold, he had the most played song in the world. He had 3 different years or something. And like, I found that guy and I made his album, and I couldn't get anybody to see what I saw, because I would recognize as a writer, at the time I didn't realize I was a writer, but I would notice what was going on, like, lyrically and melodically, and I would know, well, that person is using language in a way that's different and compelling, and I would have a hard time convincing people of it. So 2 things happened. 1, I realized I want to actually be doing this. I don't want to be a shadow artist. I don't want to be near these people. I want to be the one doing the work. I identified too strongly with them to be, I would either be too strident an advocate for them or I would get too despondent on their behalf. And it just didn't work. I loved being in the studio. I loved making records, but the rest of it was horrible. And then this other passion I had, which was for creating myself and for movies. I was someone who always memorized movies my whole life and knew every word to them. And so it became clear that the only thing to do was actually write. And I went to my best friend, Dave, who's still my creative partner. And my other big passion at the time was poker. And I was playing constantly. And I walked to a poker club and said to Dave, we should make a movie about the world of underground poker. And that was Rounders. And so we woke up early. I woke up early every single morning and before going into my job and met Dave, and we wrote the first draft of that script.
Yeah, before you said that you wrote Rounders, I was about to do like the Paul Harvey, now you know the rest of the story moment right there. Was your last music business job, was that working for Irving Azoff?
I worked for Irving, but the last job was EMI.
EMI, okay. And that was doing A&R at EMI?
Yes.
And I have to, what was it
like? That's where I signed David Gray and Fire for Fighting and D'Angelo. I mean, along with Gary Harris, I signed D'Angelo. And they all wanted to drop D'Angelo and didn't understand how great he was.
And that's another Paul Harvey, you know the rest of the story moment right there. Again, going back to Azoff, like, what was it like working for him? I mean, he's obviously this legendary music business figure known for being, rancorous at times, I guess. Like, what was your personal experience like with Azoff?
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you this, ready? If somebody went to the senator in The Godfather 2 and said, Senator, what's it like working with Michael Corleone? Would he answer that question? Or wouldn't he just say, Michael's a smart, wonderful man, and I feel honored to have been able to be by his side?
Right. So
Irving is a wonderful man, I feel honored to have been able to work by his side.
Okay, we'll take your word for it at that one. You know, you mentioned, you know, before sort of making this decision to, you know, pursue film and to write and to be a writer. I mean, it sounds like that you were, you know, disillusioned a bit with the music industry. Did that ever threaten to overtake this love of music that you have? And because obviously now you're still this big music fan, you still talk a lot about music, but was there ever a time when you were actually working in the business where you felt like, I don't know if I even like music anymore?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Did you hear? Oh, you heard my podcast with Adam Duritz. That's why you're asking the question. This is a setup, but I accept it. It's a setup. I've been set up, people. Yes, there was, in fact, a moment. And what happened was a guy I was working with called me into his office and said, I want to play you a demo I just heard. And he played me Round Here. And the reaction I had, step out the front door like a ghost in the fog, and never noticing the contrast of white on white in between the moon and you, the angels got a better view of the crumbling difference between wrong and right. And I heard that lyric, and I heard Adam sing it. And instead of at every other point in my life, my reaction would have been, holy shit, this is amazing. How can I hear more of this? I'm so happy, filled with joy that I have another great to love. My reaction was fury, anger that I hadn't come across him first, that this other person had heard him and was going to get to work with him and get the credit for it. And I had a clear moment of knowing that this thing I loved so much and held so dear and was so precious had turned into a job in a bad way. I wasn't able to keep it pure. And so for a couple of years, I had a hard time listening to new music. And when really all I ever want is to find new music. And it took about 2 years after I left the music business to sort of rediscover the ability to listen in a pure and amateur-like way.
And was there a particular artist or record that sort of snapped you out of that malaise?
Oh, that's really cool to think about. I'm just trying to go back to the 90s and figure out sort of like when that would have been, like in the late 90s. I think it was much more just like suddenly I saw, like, things had become sepia tone, and then suddenly I saw color clearly again, you know?
I mean, it seems like, you know, like when you were growing up, you know, you talked about how you were, you know, you went through this intense sort of metal phase. And I mean, would you say that you still connect to that music? I mean, would you still?
Yeah, well, you know, part of it is my dad was in the music business and was a record producer, but he would work and publisher. He worked with people like Barbara Streisand, you know, and he made pop music. And I think as a kid, the form of rebellion, you know, your father is someone who is in recording studios. It's hard for music to serve as a rebellious thing. And I love my pop. We're still incredibly close, and he would take me with him, and I learned a ton about how to talk to artists by going with him to the studio. But heavy metal became this outlet for me because he hated it. It was the only kind of music. He hated it. And that wasn't conscious on my part, but it definitely was in there that, you know, that was music that would make people look at you funny. Here's the thing. I still connect to loud, aggressive music sometimes, right? But I'm going to put on a Grant Hart or Bob Mould record, Husker Du record, that led me to a whole bunch of other music that wasn't metal because what they were. I mean, one of the great things that set Metallica apart, just to circle back, is that James was always really singing about something. I mean, you never felt that James was singing about stuff he thought the audience would like. You felt like James was really singing about what he cared about. And if the audience cared too, that was a great boon. But a lot of metal at that time, I think was pandering to a certain extent. And so I got turned off of it for that reason. And a lot of the singers in metal weren't that bright. I mean, Nikki Sixx is a super bright guy. I love the crew because, I mean, Vince, you know, I don't think anybody wants Vince taking the SATs for them. But Nikki Sixx was like super smart, you know. And obviously Axel was crazy or not, Axel was really smart, right? So I don't know if you can call Guns metal. But, like, I'll still listen to Guns.
Did you ever meet Axel?
I saw him play in a tiny club. He did two songs with LA Guns after the split, and Appetite had come out and was huge. And maybe the second album was about to come out, and there was a rumor. And you know, you always hear, back then, especially pre-internet, pre-heavy internet, you would, you know, rumors would start circling. Like people would call other people, or you'd be out somewhere, and someone would say it, and they never came true. And I remember I was in LA, and someone said Axl was going to be at the Whiskey with LA Guns, and even though it seemed like there was no way, we went to see LA Guns. This is before, I guess. Maybe they'd had Tracy had one album out or something, but you know their albums were never big. And I went with my friends, and they came out and they were kind of terrible. And then we didn't really believe each show. But then at the end of the concert in this little club, Axl came on and did two songs. And I got to tell you, man, it was like seeing Elvis or Prince or Michael, like it was just like seeing the biggest, most charismatic star you could ever see in your life in this tiny room. Like you understood immediately why he became Axl Rose. He just had a power that came from somewhere deep inside of him that when he took the stage, you know, this is pre-surgery, pre-anything, like it was all flowing through him. I mean, it was certainly like a singular music going moment of my life.
Yeah, it's always amazing when you experience something like that and you know it's happening, you know, because you to hear that, you think, oh, you're just exaggerating, you know, it's he's just a guy, he couldn't possibly have that kind of power. But then I remember seeing the White Stripes right after White Blood Cells came out, and Jack White, I think, is still the most, like at that moment, is like the most charismatic rock star I've ever seen, like in the flesh, and there's just something that like, radiates off of people like that, and I don't know what it is, but it is sort of an intangible thing.
It's some combination in the moment in time of confidence and creative supremacy, and that when that kind of confidence, and then in Jack White's case, there's some sort of empathy there too, I guess, which often comes with charisma. With Axl, I don't know if anyone would use that word, but there is this sort of raw power and aggression and need to dominate that maybe burns out. You know, I don't think Axl needs to dominate in the same way anymore or switch playing fields. But at that moment in time, you know, he wanted, you could feel that he wanted every single person in that club to know fucking Axl Rose just, and probably, you know, there was fucking, you know, Tracy Gunn sitting there on the stage, and I'm sure Axl wanted him to know, like, oh, dude, mistake, leaving the band, you know? Like, whatever he was trying to do, the effect it had on all of us was that nobody in that room ever forgot it.
Now, like, because I know you were in L.A., you know, in the late 80s, as glam metal was at its peak and also starting to, it was going to be petering out not long after that. Like, when you're on the Sunset Strip, like, scouting bands, I mean, did you just feel like this is a great place, or did you have a sense that, okay,
well, by this point in life, like, no, I mean, so I went out there. I was a New York-based A&R person, and, you know, I quickly said the thing about in college, my taste changing, but the truth is, even by my senior year of high school, I started listening to Nebraska had come out, and I really got into Bruce and Dylan, and then REM at college, and so... And then Tracy, and then Joan Armatrading, and then all the 60s folk music and country, old country. And so, like, my taste had started to change and had changed. And then, again, because of the Metallica association and knowing I was an expert, like, I was still sort of an expert on that music. I understood it. I understood what made it work. So there was a band making an album in L.A. called Faster Pussycat. And they were on the label, Elektra, and there was no A&R guy for them either. And so I agreed to, you know, I was asked, will you go to L.A. for a few months and make sure that they make a good record? And my job was basically, the way I interpreted that, was I wasn't sure how Faster Pussycat make a good record, though Tammy Downs is a very magnetic lead singer, and Brett Muscat could really play that guitar, but what I decided was I was just going to wait to hear. I was the A&R guy for them. I was like the A&R man in the Tom Petty song. Like, I had to hear the single. And Tammy Down had me over to his house, and he was wearing all the makeup and shit, like the whole Tammy Down Faster Pussycat costume. Normally at home, you know, it's like a pro wrestler. He takes the gimmick off at home, but he had the whole thing on. And he was like, I want to play you this song. They sent me a bunch of demos, and I was like, I don't think you guys are ready yet. I don't think we're ready to make an album. I don't think we're ready. And then he actually had like a whole mic set up and electric. It's all, like he sat me down, and then instead of playing an acoustic, he like stood up and played me this song at a microphone, like I was a bunch of girls with teased up hair and the audience that he was playing to. But he played me House of Pain. And as soon as he finished, I was like, oh, you're ready to go make the record. And, you know, that was like a huge single for them. And because he had, and I'll tell you what it wasn't a heavy metal song. So to answer your question, it had all changed by them. You know, I would walk around and see Jamie Lane and Janie Lane?
Yeah, from Warrant, right?
Warrant, Janie Lane. You know, you would see Janie Lane and that, you know, if you were someone who liked, you know, a lot of those guys sort of, all right, this will be something that no one else is saying. Another thing, you know, Harold Bloom's The Anxiety of Influence, the literary critical theory, which is that great work comes from a later artist or writer kind of trying to imitate one that came before, but misreading them, and then out of that misreading, creating something new. Well, I always felt like Van Halen was this band that played this loud music but had these incredible melodies. Somehow they were still incredibly cool. But all those bands that came after them trying to do what they did were like this very watered-down, poppy, they weren't saying anything. You know, Roth would say these weird things and also didn't really care. He was going to just sing about the way he saw the world in his own, like, hopped-up, ADD, whacked-out, inner voice, you know, inner consciousness. And so, like, I saw the decline of it. I didn't need Penelope Spheeris to tell me. Like, I saw the decline because so many people were out there marketing themselves. Like, they would hear the story about crew walking up and down the strip, passing out flyers. So, you know, all you saw were, like, dudes in Farrah Fawcett hair passing out flyers, and you never got the sense that they spent any time figuring out how to play the instrument or figuring out what they wanted to sing about or write about.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, you know, about that misreading of influence with Van Halen. And then you see another interesting thing after the glam metal bands, where you have a band like Pearl Jam, which came out of Mother Love Bone, which if you look at photos of Mother Love Bone, you know, they look like a glam metal band, basically. But then Pearl Jam comes along, and it's a reaction to what had come before. Not misreading it, but like reacting to it and sort of fine-tuning it and bringing it back to the hard rock roots. And then you have the next thing that comes along.
Let's be honest with each other. Let's be honest. You don't know a fucking thing about Pearl Jam, dude. I've read your book.
Yeah?
And, I mean, talk about misreading.
We're going to get into this now?
Yeah, they're one of the greatest bands that ever lived in every fucking way.
Are you saying that I'm
not
like...
I guess they did not live in reaction to Kurt Cobain. And I love your book. Let me plug your book and say it's great.
Yeah.
But reading that book as a music fan, I'm just throwing it against the wall constantly and then picking it back up.
Well, see, but I think you're misreading my book because you seem to be implying that I'm like slighting Pearl Jam, and I'm not. I actually, if you read my book, I have this book coming out in a couple months. It's about music rivalries, and I have a chapter on Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and like one of the things I talk about was how, you know, early on Kurt Cobain would constantly slag off Pearl Jam, and how that affected how Pearl Jam was perceived in a lot of quarters, certainly by me as a young rock fan. Like, it was like I hated Pearl Jam when I was 14 because I was a Nirvana fan and I felt like it was my obligation to hate them. And then I realized that I really liked Pearl Jam because the performance for me was seeing them on the 1993 MTV Video Music Awards when they played with Neil Young. Like, that was a mind-blowing performance for me. But like, I was so sucked into the credibility politics of that time as like an eighth grader that I couldn't admit that I liked Pearl Jam. So I had to pretend that I didn't for the longest time. And that's what I write about in that book. But I don't feel that way now. I mean, I love Pearl Jam now, and I would defend
them
all over the place.
Well, but I think what you talk about in the book, that's true, but your 14-year-old self seeps out in the book because you really still make it a point. You know,
well,
love reading the book, but you do say that you sort of hold to this idea that Eddie has Eddie has retold himself the story. Basically, if one reads the book, one comes away believing that what you believe is that Kurt was authentic, and maybe Eddie became authentic, but that there was an inauthenticity in the way Eddie approached
it. No, I think the point of that piece was to talk about how I think Eddie Vedder still really cares how Kurt Cobain felt about him. And yes, that has altered the narrative that's happened after Kurt Cobain died. Like, if you watch that Pearl Jam 20
documentary, everybody to read the book,
yeah,
and then tweet us and tell us whether they come away thinking that you really dig Pearl Jam. Yes, you do say you know that they're good and everything.
See, but again, that's not me slighting Pearl Jam. I think that's a true thing that they feel, but like, that's not me saying that they're inauthentic. You know, there's a nuanced point here, I think, that you are missing in that piece, perhaps.
Mm.
See, we need to talk about this after the book comes out, and then people can read it.
Then we can talk about the Prince and Michael Jackson chapter.
And then people can agree with you, and they can call me.
No, we'll talk about the Prince and Michael Jackson thing, and then I'll tell you about my night in England with Damon Albarn. When I was 24. Because I know that's a subject you'll also be interested in.
Oh, man. I feel like I want to hear this now. I feel like you're teasing things for the next podcast already, and I want to hear this right now. But, no, you know, I guess as a segue of talking about rivalries and why people feel the way that they do, you know, you mentioned before about how when you were a senior in high school, you started transitioning to, you know, listening to Springsteen and Dylan and stuff. And, you know, nowadays people listen to music and they listen to all kinds of music, you know, because it's so easy to access music. You know, you don't need to just adhere to one genre. But, you know, in the 80s and certainly when I grew up in the 90s, music fans were much more tribal. Like, if you were a metal fan, you listened to metal. If you, you know, liked grunge,
that's right,
grunge. So, I mean, that's kind of a big deal to make that kind of transition. Like, what was the catalyst for that? And did you, like, you know, did you take any shit from your friends for listening to Springsteen?
Well, a few things. I would say, one, I did always have a little bit of a catholicity of taste because of the way in which I was raised. So, you know, while I was a metal fan, I was constantly listening to song demos that people would send to our house and thinking about what made a song a good song and what didn't. So I would, like, I could use a different part of my brain for that. So I was able to kind of recognize when there would be a great song. My whole identity was as a metal fan. I wore my Van Halen jean jacket every day of my life. They were, Van Halen from age 14 to 18 were the single most important thing in the world to me. You know, it would have been like my family. If I had a girl who would like let me kiss her when I was 14, and that would maybe her and Van Halen would be the only things I would think about. And embarrassingly, I probably would think about Van Halen more. But, when a buddy of mine senior year was like, a couple things happened. One, when The River came out in 80, so that's before, that's ninth grade, even then, someone gave me The River, and I remember putting it on and feeling like, I'm not going to really deal with this right now, but this is really special. And I, you know, I'd read Cream magazine, and there was an article about Bruce and the way that he made that album and how he came up with Hungry Heart. And I remember then going, oh, let me go get that out. And I remember listening to Hungry Heart and going, okay, this is next level shit. And then hearing The River and Ties That Bind and Drive All Night. And I was like, all right. And I like put it aside and then would listen to Iron Maiden, you know. But then a buddy of mine was like, you got to hear this Nebraska album. And somehow, you know, it's time of transition as you're turning 18. And so I was still that year, 1984, when I was 18, I still, like, the band, you know, Van Halen put out 1984, and I saw them four times, and they were still my favorite thing. But, like, bubbling under it was this idea, like, I might leave this behind. Like, I might be heading in this other direction. And when Bruce came through, the very first leg of the Born in the USA tour, he was still playing. It was before the stadiums, and he was still playing a lot in Nebraska. And a buddy and I went and saw him in Jersey, and he played Highway Patrolman. He played Atlantic City, and I remember just and Johnny 99, and I just felt like the passion and anger and need to communicate and connect was so strong, and I think I was exactly the right age to be taken in by it. And then he's a gateway to all that other music, right? If you're an obsessive music person and you fall in love with what Bruce is doing, that just leads you down so many tributaries.
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day that I've liked Springsteen probably longer or as long as anybody, you know, because Born in the USA comes out in 1984 and I'm, you know, 6 years old. And that's around the same time as Thriller. And, you know, and that's really when I started being conscious of like what music was. I mean, I wasn't thinking about it in any sort of analytical way, but, you know, I was watching MTV and it was, you know, Born in the USA, it was Thriller, it was 1984, the Van Halen record, Madonna, obviously. And it is interesting to think about that because I always feel like, you know, as a rock fan, that I always want there to be a guy like that or a band like that who is on the radio or on MTV that like six-year-olds can see, and then that gets them hooked.
Well, you know, you wonder if Courtney Barnett's going to be that for people.
Exactly. That is that would be an inspiring thought.
Because she could be. She really could be. I mean, Taylor Swift is that. Like, my daughter's 16, and Taylor's been her best friend since she was 9, you
right.
know, and led her to Casey Musgraves. You know what I mean? Led her to Pistol Annie's. Like, led her to all these people singing real songs about stuff. But to me, I look at Courtney Barnett and the way she swings that guitar and what she sings about, and if she stays great, I think she's going to be she has a chance to be such an incredibly important artist, you know? Look, for me, Jason Isbell is that artist.
Right. I just saw him last night again, and it was incredible. He's like, him and the 400 Unit, that is like the most reliable live show you're going to see.
It's incredible. Did he play any old songs? Did he play Outfit?
No, it's funny. So I've seen Isbell twice in the last 3 months. I saw him the night of the Paris attacks, and that is maybe one of the best shows I've ever seen. And it he was incredible, but I was also feeling emotional that night just because like the live music experience, it's such a sacred thing to me, and to see it so violently violated like that.
Yes,
It was like an attack on anyone who loves, you know, going to shows. And Isbell just comes out and he acknowledged the attacks, you know, during the show. And he just played this beautiful show. And of course, he plays Elephant in the encore.
Yeah.
And I'm like weeping.
Well, yeah.
As I would anyway.
You don't really hear in that song, you're not a person.
But
yeah.
I was emotional anyway.
Setting. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was so great just to see this. You know, I mean, you have this horrible tragedy that happens. And then to be able to go to a Jason Isbell show and feel that experience can still be so beautiful was such a great thing for me. But then, yeah, I saw him last night. He didn't do many Drive-By Trucker songs. He did Decoration Day, and he did Never Gonna Change. But I don't think he did anything
else. I love,
else.
Like, the old 400 Unit songs, like Alabama Pines, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And, look, I think to me, he's the world's best songwriter right now. I don't think anyone's even close.
Yeah, especially if you take in the whole package, you know, where...
Yeah, I mean, look, Craig Finn is really close, but not... But to me, Craig without Tad, I understand why those guys can't make it work right now, but to me, Craig without Tad just misses something primal in what he does, and maybe it's Tad's ability to help edit Craig or to inspire him in a different way. Like, I do think the Hold Steady, when they're together, are like kind of on that level. Like, they have the capacity to make music that's you can listen to over and over and over again and get new things out of. But taking those two guys out of it, because they don't seem to be wanting to do it together anymore, I think Jason just writes the cleanest, purest, smartest songs of anybody. And they are so emotionally rich, too.
Well, and I just think certain artists, you know, and it's not just in music, it's in any art form, but you get into a certain zone, and, you know, you talk about the Hold Steady, like, those first, like, five records are just such a zone to be in, say that, well, these other records aren't as good or whatever, it's like you're almost being greedy because it's like these records are so great. Or you think about, like, the Stones from, like, 68 to 72, which, to me, is, like, the pinnacle of rock bands. Like, there's,
well, what's stunning to me is, and this would have been a good, if you do a sequel to your book, I think you can do Zeppelin In Through the Outdoor fans versus like people who think In Through the Outdoor sucks.
Yeah, well,
Because, you know, in my, like, that was a huge, I mean, that's been a 30-year argument people have had.
Wait, what side are you on that?
I'm on the, it's one of the greatest albums, rock albums ever made side.
So you think it's like the best Zeppelin album?
No, I think Zeppelin 3 is the best Zeppelin album.
Okay.
But I do think In Through the Outdoor is every bit as good as, look, I think Zeppelin never made a bad album, and I think that, I don't count Coda as an album, but I don't think anybody ever did what Led Zeppelin did.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in the realm of Led Zeppelin albums, like, In Through the Outdoor is maybe, like, not as good as, like, the other albums, which is hardly a slight if you compare that record to any other band's output. I do think it's interesting, though, that, like, when we talk about bands and you have band arguments, that there is an unwritten rule sometimes that you cannot pick the most popular record by that band as, like, the best record.
Oh,
like,
you mean, instance, you wanted me to say four? You wanted me to say,
well, exactly, like, four? Yeah, because people, like if you're a serious Zeppelin fan...
Dude, Tangerine is on three. I'm sorry, Tangerine's on three.
But I'm just saying, like, I'm saying that I follow that rule, too. Like, I would feel uncomfortable picking Led Zeppelin 4 as the best record. I always say Physical Graffiti is the best record. But, like, can you really pick against the record?
Well,
just play Devil's Advocate.
This is how people went at me on my REM list, because REM is my favorite band of all time, and like, that's the thing, you know, when that it all led to for me was REM, and
you think Automatic, though, is your favorite.
That's the towering, biggest, most important REM album, and
right.
My favorite.
Right, and
that's
by
Zeppelin
the,
4. That is Zeppelin 4.
Exactly, and John Paul Jones worked on both of those, which
yes,
is the connection.
Great
but
point.
And just, yeah, you posted this REM list on your blog, and you tweeted about it, and of like you ranked REM records, you put Automatic number one, and like, were people coming at you because they thought that was too obvious?
No, I mean, look, most it was more people had problems with other spots in it, but then yes, some people think Automatic is this overrated. That's just like, I could that's its own podcast, but I could talk for 2 hours about what they achieved. And I also love the fact that it's like clearly a Mike Mills album. It's like Mike Mills and Michael Stipe really, I think, wrote that album together in some way. You can just feel Mills at the piano and on his acoustic, like, helping to create this whole thing. Not that Peter Buck and Phil Berry didn't have a huge part, but it's, to me, singular achievement in their career. But my point was, I don't have to pick the cool thing because I picked Automatic, right?
Right.
I could have picked Fables. Fables is an incredibly important album to me. I could have said Fables is the best REM album, but it's not. Automatic is. I think with Zeppelin, it's a lot closer. And here's what I'd say about, like, In Through the Outdoor, and why I think is an interesting conversation, is, like, if you listen to the way John Bonham plays drums on In Through the Outdoor, I mean, and, like, on Fool in the Rain, I mean, he was just finding a new way to get inside this incredibly powerful melodic drumming that he did. And I think Fool in the Rain would be, like, the best or second best song on almost any Zeppelin album.
And you have a song like All of My Love, which is not certainly like a classic sounding Zeppelin song. And
well, neither is Fool in the Rain.
Neither is Fool in the Rain, but just a beautiful pop song. Like, nothing like it really in Led Zeppelin's catalog. That album's interesting too, because that was like when Jimmy Page was like, you know, peak heroin addict period, and it was like John Paul Jones took control musically of that record. So it's a lot different sounding than the other Zeppelin records. I love it. I love that record too. I always think it's interesting though when people argue that that's the best Zeppelin album, because I feel like, I think there was a list for Vulture. Vulture did like the best Zeppelin songs ever, and I think the guy that wrote that argued that In Through the Outdoor was the best album, which I think that's an intriguing case, but I also feel like you're intentionally trying to piss people off.
Well, but to me, I think the thing is what I really have a problem with is people saying it's the worst Zeppelin album. I don't see that it's the worst Zeppelin album.
What's the worst, in your opinion, then?
Presence.
Yeah, I don't know. See, I feel like when you're going to say the worst Zeppelin album, that's like saying worst Coen Brothers movie or something.
I mean,
it's
right.
Like I would take the worst over anyone's best,
you
take usually.
Presence almost over anybody else's album, almost. Hey, dude, I got to wrap this up.
Okay. I was just about to let you go. Okay, well, Brian, I think we could be arguing about Zeppelin albums here for the next 2 hours, but I should probably let you go.
Thank you.
But we've already made allusions to a sequel to this podcast. I know you want to yell at me about my book at some point, so I definitely want to have you on again.
I want to celebrate like the 30th anniversary of Life Rich Pageant with you,
okay.
Which I think is soon.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, we will definitely, I think that's this summer. So let's delve into REM and the book and all that at a
great.
Later date. But hey, Brian, thanks again. It was great talking with you.
This is a blast. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right, take care. All right, that was Brian Koppelman. Great conversation. And I think, as you could tell from that, we're going to definitely have him on again because we had a lot more to talk about and a lot more to argue about. So I'm looking forward to that. Guys, if you like the podcast, and I really hope you do, it would be a great help to us if you could help us spread the word. So, you know, tell your friends about us, talk about us on social media, and if you have a couple, you know, minutes, go on iTunes and give us a review or even just give us a rating. All of these things are a tremendous help to us in terms of growing the podcast because word of mouth is always the best advertising. If you want to know more about our podcast, please head over to Twitter. You can find us on there. We're at CeleRockPod. That's C-E-L-E Rock Pod. We have information about our guests, and we like to post playlists occasionally. And it's a good way to also meet up with other fans who check out the podcast. So other than that, I think we are all set. So thank you for listening to this week's episode, and we'll see you next week.